So this is talking with Harry Minette on 2nd March 78 at Radio Physics in Sydney. So to start, could you just tell me what your educational background was and how you, when you first got working in radio engineering and so forth?
Mm-hmm. Well, I went to Sydney University after the high school education and started in engineering. And the engineering course at Sydney University is organized in a special way, which was a very good way, as it turned out, due to Sir John Matson. That meant that after 2 years of engineering, which was a general course, every engineer did the same course. If you're interested in more mathematics and physics, you went over to the science faculty for 1 year and did the final year of mathematics and physics for a science degree. And many of us here did that. And then I came back to the electrical engineering department, specialised in electrical and mechanical engineering. They went together in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Did the third year, and then part of the third year was 6 months in industry. We went out and worked in factories and so on for 6 months. And then came back for the final year, and this was the honours year. If you were going to do an honours degree, you did this. And there were six of us at that time. Did honours, and that was going to take us up to the end of 1939, because the war started in September 1939.
Mm-hmm.
And various people in the honours group were asked about what they wanted to do after they graduated, and that there was a project starting up, which was secret, and they couldn't tell us what it was about, except it was of a defensive nature and rather important. And in the event, they picked three of us out. I think we were the top three, actually. It was Jack Warner, who's the chief of cloud physics, and myself. We were the top two in that year, and another chap, Tenji. And after we graduated, we moved over, I think it was in April 1940, into this building, which had been built on the back of the National Standards Laboratory. It was known that war was likely and the need for standards in Australia was recognised, and people had been sent overseas to train. They came back and there was a building being built. Well,
this is still on the University of Sydney
grounds.
It's
still on the University grounds, and it's only a matter of a quarter of a mile from electrical engineering department. And the radar had started by the British government informing the governments of the Commonwealth countries like Australia and Canada and so on, that they had this invention, and inviting them to send a senior physicist to Britain to find out about it. And Dr. D.F. Martin was the man sent over, from the Radio Research Board, which was in the Electrical Engineering Department. And when he came back, and this is covered very well in the war history, they set up various organisations, but committees of control, but it was decided to set up a radio physics division. They called it radio physics to cover up. And they had to put it somewhere, so they thought the least conspicuous place was to just add to the building, which was going to be national standard.
Mm-hmm.
Put an extra part on the back and then lock that off from the national standards. And that became the radio physics division, and that was ready in April 1940. So they picked out the three of us, and there were a number of people in the department already had started work. They were already part of radio physics with nowhere to go, but they'd started. And there was J.L. Pawsey, who turned up towards the end of 1939. There was Jack Piddington, Victor Bergman, the chairman of CSIRO, but he was our Jack Warner, and I was supervised by the honours year, supervised by him. He was about 1 year ahead of us. And Len Hibbard, who after the war went to work with Oliphant in Birmingham and up at Canberra on the accelerators that he was devising at that time, is now back in the National Measurements Lab on their frequency standard work.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Pulley, who had been in the Radio Search Board and went to AWA, and they're all working there, and they sort of all transferred over. But there was a small nucleus of Radio Research Board experienced people like Piddington and Pulley and Pawsey, of course, and a few others. But in the main, it was a lot of young people, recent graduates that could get hold of. And each year there'd be a fresh intake from Sydney University, which was the course that Madsen had instituted was about right, you know, the right level of mathematics and physics. And he got great credit for having seen the need for this way back in the 1930s and having got it going. And we started in 1940, and I was asked to work with Pawsey, which is a great stroke of luck. And he was an antenna man, basically, worked on television antennas in EMI in England. And
I just heard this story from someone that he always liked to tell the story of installing the television, first television in Buckingham Palace.
Oh, yes.
Can you lend any credence to this?
Oh, no, it's not one I heard in detail. I've heard it at one time or another, but I never got it from him. He was a marvellous fellow. The sort of frequency bands that the radars were operating on, meter wavelengths, were all brand new. It's a new part of the spectrum. You couldn't get books on it. And it was in the heads of the people who were in a few places like EMI and RCA, Bell Telephones, places like that, that were right in the forefront of technique. So he was a real centre of this new knowledge, more so than other radio research board people who had been working on ionosphere and used those sort of wavelengths. They were very good on the pulse techniques. But Pawsey was the centre of all knowledge of meter wavelengths, and there was practically nothing you could buy. So he had to invent impedance measuring equipment. Mm-hmm. All sorts of things.
He worked for EMI, you say?
Yeah. It was EMI that worked on the first British television system before the war, and he did the Alexandra Palace, where they broadcast from, the television aerials there. And I remember he had a paper by Pawsey and Cork at that time, which was quite a classic. Mm. He was extremely experienced with anything to do with transmission lines and antennas of those sort of wavelengths, and extremely inventive, very, very good physicist. So I was lucky to work with him, and went straight into the development of a radar antenna. The first project was a shore defence system to fire the guns. We had 9.2-inch guns around the Sydney cliffs, and they were ranged by the radars we produced, and cross-triangulation, and also they had optical finders when you could see it. Mm-hmm. But if you didn't, you could get across two ranges. And that was the shore defence system. So I was working on antennas for him, 36-element broadside arrays with means of swinging the beam with rotating condenser switching, with the beam flickering backwards and forwards to get direction finding. And common aerial working was transmitting and receiving at the same time, so there had to be a means of protecting the receiver by switching over very rapidly with the pulses. And this was done with little diodes, first of all, and then later on by gas discharge tubes. So that was the field of work for a couple of years.
These were what are called TR switches?
Yes, transmit-receive switches. Right. And that was some of the first work on common aerial working. British sort of early stations had been separate transmitting and receiving, but they were more or less going parallel with what we were doing.
A general question is, was there a lot of duplication in terms of you people developing a gun radar and the British were developing a gun radar at the same time?
Not really. The requirements were different in the two countries. They'd concentrated enormously on aircraft warning because they were so vulnerable. That was the prime mover, first of all. And then gradually they got into everything, the Army and the Navy and so on. But the requirements were different. Here it had to be decided what to work on, and I suppose protection of Sydney under attack with the big guns they had, being able to fire in the darkness was an attractive one. Although in the event when Japan came in December 1941, it would have been better then to have had an air warning radar.
Yeah.
And the shore defence system was redesigned in a week by Piddington and Brian Cooper into an air warning system, and one was made up in our workshops in an incredibly short time and installed at Dover Heights. And then a whole number of them were made to go up north. One got to Darwin a bit late, but the second one caught the next ray after they got it operating. It sort of threw a whole crisis into the radio physics laboratory because of the sudden switch. the shore defence stuff had been got going. We had to get the air warning stuff going, and the group under Piddington, Brian Cooper, did the design work that I was involved in the antennas. They were adapted from the shore defence thing, 36 element array. And they had to be installed up and down the coast, so we were all very busy up as far as New Guinea and down south of Sydney.
That was that basically a military decision to make this switch?
Well, I suppose the joint decision by the Radio Physics Advisory Board, which included military people on it, and I think they could see it coming, because before Pearl Harbor and before Darwin was raided, I'd been asked to look at some of the British chain stations. There were certain bits of their equipment lying around out there to see whether it could be adapted for the defence of Darwin. But it was a bit late. The system that we developed was a much better one, short wavelength. In the event, it was very successful and gave enormous range in your country, is it, preference. Out here, it was transportable. They could fly it around everywhere. They get the super refraction effects and get enormous ranges. And very, very successful. And then microwaves came along, of course. That was a big thing from about 1942 onwards. And that was sort of super successful because the magnetron. And Pawsey formed a group on microwave developments, fundamental component developments. I went into that.
But now here's a case, of course, where the magnetron was also carted over to the radiation lab at MIT.
Yes, yes.
Now, was there not a lot of duplication going on there, don't you think?
Well, we didn't duplicate their work except as a source of supply. The main centre for magnetron work was overseas. I think we didn't get into magnetrons ourselves, but there was a group at Sydney at Melbourne University who did. And it's purely a matter of procurement. And specifically the wavelength of operation. If you couldn't get